We're up to chapter 13, as you well know. Who remembers something from chapter 12 a whole week ago? Dhruva Maharaj goes back to Godhead. That says something about what happened. Anyone remember? Yes.
He prayed for constant remembrance and constant faith in the Supreme Krishna to guide those requests to Manu.
Now how about from the last chapter? But that point really sticks. How Dhruva changed so much from the beginning of his life when he was a young boy. In great anger, he went to the forest to find Krishna, and he actually found him. And his desire was very childish, to have a kingdom greater than the universe, greater than his grandfather's, Lord Brahma's kingdom. But then after he actually saw the Lord, his heart was changed so much. And then the next time he had an opportunity to ask for a benediction, what did he want? He wanted simply full faith and remembrance of Krishna. So there's obviously something for us to learn in that as to what is truly valuable for us to attain. Something from the last chapter.
Guru Maharaj gave up his kingdom.
Yes.
He started meditating on the Absolute Brahma. And he attained the Bhava state. Then Vaikuntha presence came.
Yes.
And he chanted the Hari name.
Yes. And Suniti also went back to Godhead in this way. Very heart-rendering, that part. Also, I always found it interesting how Dhruva Maharaj stepped upon the head of death as he mounted the Vaikuntha aeroplane for a materialistic person, or rather for anyone who has any attachment to the body. The time of death is truly most terrifying. It is really terrifying. It's not a joke. It's not theoretical. There is a Bengali saying that whatever bhajan we do, whatever worship we do, it will be tested at the time of death. We can be a good speaker, we can be a good this, we can be a good that. Everyone could be convinced we're wonderful devotees, but the real test will be at the time of death, how tightly we're able to hold on to the feet of Krishna. And for someone who is deep enough in his Krishna consciousness, death becomes something to step upon its head on the way back to Godhead. But if we're not deep enough, then, oh, it's terrifying. Terrifying. Right at the end of the chapter, Narada Muni recites three verses. He's very ecstatic to describe the qualities and characteristics of Dhruva Maharaj, and, or not Narada Muni, but it's described, three verses that Narada Muni spoke in the presence of the Prachetas. Do you remember that? Remember that part? There were three verses, quite nice verses. And that is the key. That particular little section right at the end is the key to the next question that Vidura is going to ask. So Suta Goswami is describing these pastimes to the sages of Namasharanya, and he continued to speak to all the rishis headed by Shonaka, and he said, after hearing Maitreya Rishi describe Dhruva Maharaj's ascent to Lord Vishnu's abode, Vidura became very much enlightened in devotional emotion. So Vidura, the word here is Prarudha Bhavo Bhagavati Erhoksha Jay. So Prarudha, he increased his bhava, his devotional emotion or his devotional ecstasy. Bhagavati, unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that who is at Hokshaja, No one can perceive him by one's mental and intellectual abilities. He's beyond direct perception. He is only perceivable by how? By bhakti, when he chooses to reveal himself. So on hearing how Dhruva Maharaj, just a boy, look at his attainment. So there was devotional, there was ecstasy, there is hope in Vidura. Because Dhruva had received so much mercy from the Lord and directly from Narada Muni. So therefore, he became very much enlightened in devotional emotion and he inquired from Maitreya as follows. We won't read all of Prabhupada's purports to this chapter because we have the task of finishing the entire chapter. But we'll pick some from here and some from there. And this particular chapter, it's more or less it's a transitional chapter between the pastimes of Dhruva Maharaj, and these are all descendants of Dhruva Maharaj, because the third and fourth cantos describe the descendants of Swayambhuva Manu, especially Uttanapad, from Dhruva Maharaj onward. There is a description of Uttanapad's descendants, and prior to that, in the third canto, there are descriptions of other of the children of Swayambhuva Manu's descendants. But here we're going to hear, in this remaining canto, about the descendants of Uttanapad and the dynasty of Dhruva Maharaj as it continues. And the Prachetas will be born in that dynasty. Now, in this chapter, there are going to be three personalities that are discussed. The one who's discussed in the greatest detail is the real bad one, and that's Maharaj Vena. We'll hear about one descendant of Dhruva Maharaj, his son named Utkal, who is a Mahabhagavat. And we'll, even though there's not really much emphasis placed upon him, let's try to understand something about the consciousness of a Mahabhagavat. And then, later on, we'll hear about the father of Maharaj Vena, who is called Anga, Maharaj Anga. And he is not a Mahabhagavat, but yet he does something very, very wonderful. And then comes Vena Maharaj, who is exactly the opposite of a Mahabhagavat. Because a Mahabhagavat sees, as we'll hear, he sees Krishna everywhere. Ishta Deva Sporti. Tavamam dagamam deki na deki taramuti savachahaya nija ishtadeva spurti. He sees everything as Krishna's manifestation. And Vena, the opposite of a Mahabhagavat, had the audacity to see everything basically as a manifestation of himself. So he, in our common language, is a demon. So we're going to hear about these three different personalities, and we'll look at them in not great depth, but just to mine some of the sweetness and great knowledge that the Bhagavatam is offering us. So here is Prabhupada's purport to this first text, which describes Vidura's enlightenment and enthusiasm to have heard about Dhruva Maharaj. Prabhupada's purport. As evidenced in the topics between Vidura and Maitreya, and these topics, by the way, continue from the beginning of the third canto to the end of the fourth canto, and then they are finished. The activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the devotees are so fascinating that neither the devotee who is describing them nor the devotee who is hearing is at all fatigued by the inquiries and answers. Now, what hits you about that? I'll read a little further. But what hits you about that? They are not at all fatigued by hearing and speaking and chanting about Krishna. Prabhupada continues, transcendental subject matter is so nice that no one becomes tired of hearing or speaking. Think about that. Others who are not devotees may think, how can people devote so much time simply to talks about God? That's a very sobering statement. But devotees are never satisfied or satiated. What does satiated mean? Feeling I've had enough. Just like we may be very hungry at the time of a feast or very thirsty. Then we drink one cup of water and then two cups of water or three cups of water. And then at some point we've had enough and we don't want any more. That's satiated. But devotees never become satiated in hearing and speaking about the Supreme Personality of Godhead or about His devotees. And notice that Dhruva Maharaj is a devotee and Vidura became ecstatic hearing about a devotee. The more they hear and talk, the more they become enthusiastic to hear. The chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra is simply the repetition of how many words? Three words. Hare Krishna and Rama. But still, devotees can go on chanting this Hare Krishna mantra 24 hours a day without feeling fatigued. Now, what strikes you about that? It's not my case. So, didaiva midrisam ihan anujano raga. Unfortunate as I am, Itadrasi tava kripa bhagavan mamapi. Krishna is so kind. He comes in the form of the holy names. He comes in the form of the Bhagavatam. But unfortunate as I am, I have no attraction. So what is the cause of the dudaivam, or the misfortune, or the unfortunateness? Bhaktivinoda Thakura explains this clearly. That's one of them, and that's perhaps the main one. Yes. Offenses. Yes. Ignorance, tattva vibhrama. Yes, ignorance. Offenses, the same. No taste, but what is the cause of no taste? Offenses, taste for the wrong thing. Asat trishna, taste for the temporary. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, riddaya dolabham, weakness. This is the nature of the conditioned soul. We are in a very precarious position in the material world, because rather than having a taste on this side, on the spiritual side, we have a taste on the material side. So our position is always dangerous. So life's purpose is to develop this taste, to advance, to develop the desire to love Krishna. Very sobering when Prabhupada says this is a devotee. How casually we criticize others. Many years ago, during Kartik, all the devotees, I don't know if devotees still do it. We take some type of a vrata. This year I won't eat this, I'll chant more rounds, I'll do this, I'll walk around. Just like so many devotees did in Purushottama. So one devotee said, why don't you do something interesting? Because you've done no sweets, this, that, for so many years. Why don't you take the vow not to criticize anyone for Kartik? And that was the most interesting vow I ever took, because I lasted about a day. And what I saw was, rather than Because romantically, oh, it would be so nice, I won't criticize anyone for a month. But what I really saw is how often I do criticize, just for no reason actually, casually. He's like this. Very distasteful actually, very distasteful. And if you actually catch yourself doing it, we see why we're not on this level, because chanting Hare Krishna is very wonderful, and yet to dive amid some yan anuraga. So Vidura, he began to question now, and Sutta is mentioning this to, he's speaking this to Shonaka Rishi and the other sages. He inquired for Maitreya, O greatly advanced devotee, who were the Pachetas, to which family did they belong? Whose sons were they, and where did they perform the great sacrifices? So everything, because of the intellectual and spiritual curiosity of Vidura, everything he heard with an awake mind, an awake consciousness. And everything reacted in his consciousness, and he wanted to know. He wasn't dull-brained. He wanted to know more and more. Text 3. So Vidura, he asked further, I know that the great sage Narada is the greatest of all devotees. He has compiled the Pancharatriki procedure of devotional service. Pancharatriki means temple worship, deity worship, and has directly met the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's obviously a great, an ordinary person or an ordinary devotee that can't meet the Lord. But so he's obviously so qualified. He's the son of Lord Brahma. Prabhupada in his purport says that he makes a distinction between the Bhagavat Marg or the Bhagavat Vidhi and the Pancharatriki Vidhi or the deity worship, and that the Krishna consciousness movement, and indeed it is based on both of these together. And it defines what the Bhagavad Vidhi is following the Bhagavatam and the devotees in the Bhagavatam and the hearing and chanting that the Bhagavatam is recommending continuously. So the Krishna consciousness movement is based on these two going parallel, the Bhagavata Marg and the Pancharatriki Vidhi Marg. The deity worship and the hearing and chanting of the Bhagavatam. Text 4. While all the Prachetas were executing religious rituals and sacrificial ceremonies, and thus worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead for His satisfaction, just something so simple like that, you can read that text 100 times and miss the word, the worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead for His satisfaction. But that is the essence of bhakti. That when one's activities are done, not for one's own satisfaction, but for Krishna's satisfaction. Then, when one has that type of surrender, that yes, I am Krishna's servant. I am not separate from Krishna. I am not independent. I am not in the material world independently. As if I'm the enjoyer and as if I'm the controller. How much anxiety we attain in this life because of this simple conditioned tendency to be the controller and the enjoyer. All conditioned souls share this. Based on ahankara, vamudatma, based on false ego. So we tend to take this tendency even into our devotional service, and therefore our devotional service never really becomes devotional or service. It just becomes karma, or it tends in that direction. Just some work that we do with me still in the center. So there must be surrender for it to be devotional service. Surrender is the beginning of bhakti. Things should be done for Krishna's pleasure. So that's 3 words or And thus worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, explaining that the Prachetas were doing this, the great sage Narada described the transcendental qualities of Dhruva Maharaj. So gradually, over the next quite a few chapters, by the time we reach perhaps the 25th chapter in this canto, I can't remember the exact name, but then we number, but I think it's 25. Then we really get into the Prachetas, and then later on in the last two chapters of the canto, we'll complete the pastime of the Prachetas. But everything is that will be spoken is leading to that in the sense of it answers the inquiry of Vidura to Maitreya about who the Prachetas were. My dear Brahmana, how did Narada Muni glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead? And what pastimes were described in that meeting? I'm very eager to hear of them. Kindly explain fully about the glorification of the Lord. In the beginning of the third chapter, third canto, Vidura asks about Maitreya Muni, about the creation of the universe, but he specifically wanted to hear everything in relationship to Krishna, or the Lord's glory. So this is the essence of a devotee's inquiries. And without that essence, he doesn't feel it, there is no inspiration. So now Maitreya begins his reply. My dear Vidur, when Maharaj Dhruva departed for the forest, his son Utkal did not desire to accept the opulent throne of his father, which was meant for the ruler of all the lands of this planet. So interesting already that when we can just read it and pass over it lightly, but think, what does it take for someone not to want to be in control over the entire world? Perhaps it's someone already who had experience managing something and he's had enough. But these personalities were very powerful. The reason why it's so difficult for us to manage is we lack power and we lack authority. And you can't manage without authority and power. But these personalities, they were direct descendants of Dhruva Maharaj, of Swayambhuva Manu, of Uttanapad. They were extremely powerful. And they had great authority. And that means, as the king, they had unlimited opulence. But yet he didn't want to rule. What could cause that? Everyone in the material world wants the position of rulership and controllership. This is why we're in the material world. But Utkal didn't want it. Why? From his very birth, Utkal was fully satisfied. He himself was an exalted soul. He didn't require anything from the material world. Indeed, the material world cannot bring us the satisfaction that we long for. Indeed. And yet, we can't give up our attempts in the material world unless we attain some realizations like Utkala, purity. So he was fully satisfied and unattached to the world. He was equipoised, for he could see everything resting in the Supersoul. He saw everything in existence. Everywhere he looked, he saw everything in existence is none different from the Supersoul. And he saw the Supersoul present in everyone's heart. So everywhere he looked, he saw the Lord. Samadarshana. This is the purity of vision of an Uttama Bhagavat. Prabhupada explains in this purport about halfway down, a highly advanced Mahabhagavat devotee sees in this spirit that's described. He sees the same Supersoul, Paramatma, existing within everyone's heart, regardless of discrimination based on the different material forms of the living entities. There is no Icha Dvesha. I don't like this one. I dislike that one. I'm repulsed by this one. I'm attracted by that one. There's none of that for an exalted soul. He sees everything in relationship to Krishna. He sees everyone as part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just like a mother or a father, he or she loves each and every one of the children. He cannot avoid it. As we'll see, Vena's mother loved him. And he was such a terrible personage. The Mahabhagavat, who experiences the Supreme Godhead's presence everywhere, is never missing from the sight of the Supreme Lord. What was that last thing that I read? Yes. Usually we say that the Lord is not missing from His sight. What verse, text in the Brahma Samhita? Premanjana Charita Bhakti Velochanena Santa Sadaiva Videsho Velochanti Yajshayama Sundaram Machinta Guna Sarupam Govindam Maripurusham Tamaham Vajami. But here, which would you rather be? In what sense? Would you rather have the Lord in your sight or always be in the Lord's sight? Both will go simultaneously. But it is two-sided. Because the devotee, exalted devotee, always sees Krishna, yayetam mam papadyante, and he's always thinking of pleasing Krishna. Therefore Krishna reciprocates by always thinks of his devotee. Indeed, in the pastime of Ambarish Maharaj, when Durvasa goes to Vaikuntha and asks for the Lord's protection, incredible what the Lord says. He said, the Lord is always in my heart. Excuse me, the devotee is always in my heart. So what we're trying, just the simple points, right now we're on text 7, and this isn't in one level a significant chapter, it's a transition chapter. But just see what it means to be a devotee, how alive a devotee is. He could hear and chant about Krishna 24 hours a day because of his love for Krishna. And on the other hand, that devotee is never absent from Krishna's sight. Because one may think, okay, I think about Krishna all the time, but what about me? Who's going to take care of me? And really, one has to confront this question on a very deep level before one can surrender to Krishna, before one will trust himself in Krishna's hands. If I give myself fully to Krishna, who is going to take care of me? We all know the answer. 1, 2, 3. Krishna! But when it comes to difficult times in life, at least I've been watching my own mind, does my mind take shelter of Krishna so easily? Hardly, I'm embarrassed to admit. Rather, it gets angry at everyone, one after another, after another, after another. It's so embarrassing being a conditioned soul. So one really must become deep in the Bhagavatam. Not superficially, but deeply, we have to allow the Bhagavatam to take us deeply. And let it build our desires to love Krishna. And to be the kind of devotees that we're hearing about. And then the question is always the same. Are we willing to pay the price? Dhruva Maharaj was willing to pay the price. The Prachetas will hear, were willing to pay the price. Prachini Barishat was willing to pay the price. Maharaj Vena was not willing to pay the price of giving up himself being the central figure in the universe. He refused. Even when the sages requested him, he refused. So we have to deeply answer this question for ourselves, and if we see that we're not quite ready, then we have to see what to do. And of course, we're going to get some very good advice on what to do very soon. So Prabhupada explains here that Utkal's consciousness in the last sentence in the purport, he says, this is possible, this vision is possible only when one is advanced in love of Godhead. That means there is no cheap way. One has to become advanced. By expansion of his knowledge of the Supreme Brahman, he had already attained liberation from the bondage of the body. So he attained Atmanam Brahman Nirvanam Pratyastamita Vigraham. He had no relationship with his body anymore. In other words, he fully identified himself as spiritual and as Krishna's. Fully, no identification with the body. This cannot be bluffed, imitated. Because Prabhupada is saying this is possible only when one is advanced in love of Godhead. You can't imitate these things, and therefore we're always told not to imitate, but rather we should advance from our actual position. So this liberation from the bondage of the body is called nirvana. He was situated in transcendental bliss, and he continued always in that blissful existence. So how can one give up identification with this nasty body that we're so attached to? Love of God, which awards one with blissful existence. It can't be done by either the strength of mind or intelligence. It has to be done param dvistva navartite, by a higher taste. And then, when the material pleasures appear insignificant, tuchavat, like the Goswami, tucha, insignificant. So by tasting bliss, which expanded more and more, what does that remind us of? Yes, this is what I was thinking. Anandam bhudivardhanam pradipatam, an ever-increasing ocean of bliss. And indeed, that's what Prabhupada is going to recommend as the process in his purport. Teto dharpanam arjanam bhava maha devagni namapanam seya karayva chandrika vitaranam. This was possible for him by continual practice of bhakti yoga, which is compared to a fire because it burns away all dirty material things. He was always situated in his constitutional position of self-realization, and he could not see anything else but the Supreme Lord and himself engaged in discharging devotional service. It was effortless. The river of his devotion was flowing. It was effortless. So Prabhupada explains here, these two verses explain the verse in Bhagavad Gita 18:54, Brahmabhuta Prasanama. This explains the Brahmabhuta platform, the Sochatina Kamchati, Samasaveshu Bhuteshu Madbhaktim Labhate Param. One who is transcendentally situated at once realizes the Supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments nor desires to have anything. He is equally disposed towards every living entity. In that state, he achieves pure devotional service unto me. So one has to be above these material attractions. And how does one get above the material attractions to attain devotional service? One has to perform devotional service. And then gradually one attains more happiness. And then one is able to surrender more. more surrender, more bhakti, more happiness, etc. like that. This is also explained by Lord Chaitanya in his Shikshastak in the beginning of the first verse. Cheto dopanamajanam bhavamaha devagni navaparam shreyakaraya chandrika vataranam vidyavaro jivanam. The bhakti yoga system, so this is how to be engaged always in bhakti yoga and to cleanse the heart. And in this system, the chanting of the holy name of the Lord is the foremost performance of devotional service. By chanting the holy name, one can attain the perfection of nirvana, or liberation from material existence, and so increase one's blissful life of spiritual existence as described by Lord Chaitanya. Anandam buddhivardhanam. When one is situated in that position, he no longer has any interest in material opulence or even a royal throne and sovereignty over the entire planet, the whole planet. This situation is called viraktya nyatra syat, detachment from everything. It is the result of devotional service, and it is the result of anandam buddhivardhanam, being immersed in the ever-increasing ocean of bliss. So Utkal appeared to the less intelligent persons on the road to be foolish, blind, dumb, deaf, and mad, although actually he was not so. He was completely neutral to the material world. The good and bad of this world did not affect him at all because he had no attachment to his body. Just imagine again how deep his realization had to be to actually be on that platform. And that is the platform that's going to be required at the time of death for each and every one of us, a detachment from the material body. Because if we have attachment to our bodies, we're going to be very, very upset at the time of death, because that thing that we've relied on for our whole life, that we've identified with, that we depend on, like our qualities, like maybe we can see, we have some strength, and we have our intelligence, we have so many, whatever it is that we have, whatever facilities our particular bodies awards us, some athletic ability, some singing ability. But each and every one of those, if we identify with them as us, as we approach death, they are each and every one of them, they are stolen away slowly by old age and quickly. At the time of death, we won't be able to eat even. We won't be able to see. We won't be able to taste, no strength. I remember when we were dealing with Ocha Mataji, she told me that if you touch her body like this, her hand like this, as light as possible, she said that causes her excruciating pain. She said that when her husband died, he was like that and she couldn't understand it. You think, oh, being a little dramatic or something like that. But she said, now I can understand it. It's really heavy. It's heavy stuff. So that's on one side the kick to push us away from our material attachments. Everything, if we identify with these qualities of the body, with everyone that we lose, it's going to be like losing part of ourself. That's painful. It's going to be so painful. So we are requested to give up this identification with the body. Otherwise, it's a source of misery. Sarira avidya jala jatendra taika. Source of misery. On one side, material misery is an impetus. On the other side, anandam buddhivardhanam, we are meant to increase our spiritual taste. because simply being affected by material miseries is not sufficient. Misery is no qualification for going forward in spiritual life. It can be a little bit of a push, but it's really the positive that does more. Because misery just makes one miserable. The mind becomes so dissatisfied when we're miserable. Yet, the material world, we can guarantee, we can know for sure that it will kick us. And if you're not happen to be being kicked at this moment, just be patient. It's just now coming. But on the other side, it's the positive that gives life to a devotee. Chanting Hare Krishna, Panchanga Bhakti. So he appeared, he made himself like a madman. This happens many times. Jad Bharat, we see, does this, Dattatreya Muni. Why do they do that? Why do they just appear like that? Even Yudhisthira Maharaj, when he left this world, why do they do this, take on this appearance? They don't want people to bother them. They're involved in their internal meditation and they don't want to be bothered. Prabhupada mentions in the purport, these are called bhajananandi. Sometimes we have, for ISKCON, the word bhajananandi has a negative, very negative connotation, because Prabhupada criticized bhajananandis, but it's really, the criticism is more of people who aren't anandis. Because if one is actually deeply involved in the ananda of his worship of Krishna, then there's no fault. Although there is also a need, as Prabhupada points out, for the ghosti anandi, the traveling preachers, who gets bliss out of doing Krishna's work, serving Krishna, doing Krishna's work of bringing souls back to Godhead. But anyway, Utkal was not a ghosti anandi, he was a bhajan anandi. And he appeared as if a madman. And for this reason, the ministers and the elderly members of the family thought Utkal to be without intelligence and in fact mad. Thus his younger brother named Vatsar, the son of Brahmi, was elevated to the royal throne and he became king of the world. So Prabhupada in his purport points out that the king, he wasn't the dictator. You know, just, I think this should be like this. And, you know, there was a system of advisors. And he listened to his advisors. So now moving from Utkal to Vatsara. He had a very dear wife whose name is Svaravinti. And she gave birth to 6 nuns named Pushparna, Timaketu, Isha, Urja, Vasu, and Jai. Pushparna had 2 wives named Prabha and Dosha. Prabha had 3 sons named Pratar, Madhya, Dinam, and Sayam. Dosha had 3 sons, Pradosha, Nishishta, and Vyusta. Vyusta's wife, so there's generations going on here. Vyusta's wife was Pushkarini, and she gave birth to a very powerful son named Sarvateja, which means all-powerful. Sarvateja's wife, Akuti, gave birth to a son named Chakshusha, who became the 6th Manu at the end of the Manu millennium. Nadval, the wife of Chakshusha Manu, gave birth to the following faultless sons: Puru, Kuksha, Trita, Dyumna, Satyavan, Rita, Vrata, Agnishtoma, Atiratra, Prajumna, Sibi, and Ulmuka. Of the 12 sons, Ulmuka begot 6 sons and the wife. And his wife Pushkarini, they were all very good sons, and the names were Anga, he's the main one. Shumana, Khyati, Kratu, Angira, and Kaya. Now, why is Anga the important son that we're concerned with here? It's because his son was named Venu. The wife of Anga, Suniti, gave birth to a son named Vena. So this is Maitreya Muni explaining this to Vidura, who was very crooked. The saintly King Anga was very disappointed with Vena's bad character, and he left home. He left home and kingdom and went out to the forest. So just imagine how disappointed he was. So on one hand, we heard about Utkal, who couldn't care about anything in the material world, because if you're a madman, if people think you're a madman, they treat you, it's not like people are respectful to you. They spit on you, they throw things at you, they laugh at you, they make fun of you. And he was completely aloof from this. Anything, no reaction. But Anga was not on that level. So it described, he went to the forest. He was so disturbed. So was that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, here, he had such a bad son, and he laments, this is causing me so much pain. But he sees something good in it. So if we're not on the Utkal level, we should become on the Anga level, but we shouldn't become on the Vena level. But look, we'll hear, because Vidura is intrigued by this. So Maitreya says to Vidura, when great sages curse, their words are as invincible as a thunderbolt. Has anyone, there was one storm a few weeks ago where there were such heavy thunderbolts that were close. It was quite terrifying. I mean, the thunderbolts, they're heavy. So the sages, did you remember that storm? You were having class during that time? Yeah. Were you inspired in your class to it? So there, as a thunderbolt is invincible, you may be strong, but if you get hit by a thunderbolt, you're finished. So the sage's curses were as powerful and as invincible as a thunderbolt. Thus when they cursed King Vena out of anger, he died. And after his death, since there was no king, all the rogues and thieves flourished. The kingdom became unregulated and all the citizens suffered greatly. On seeing this, the great sages took the right hand of Vena as a churning rod. And as a result of their churning, Lord Vishnu, in his partial representation, made his advent as King Prithu, the original emperor of the world. So he is called Adhiraj. He embodied, he's a jiva. Prithu Maharaj is a jiva tattva. But he carries, he's a vesh, shakta vesh. He carries the potency of the Lord within him for ruling. So be very, there's quite a The pastimes of Prithu Maharaj will go for quite a few chapters, and there's many, many interesting things in them, and we shall get there, if so willing. So Vidura immediately became enthusiastic because remember his question, original question was about the Prachetas, and what he was getting by this answer of the generations, he's getting to the Prachetas. But now, he's going to ask a question that stops a very quick march to the pastime of the Prachetas. And he's going to hear about the Lord's incarnation of Prithu Maharaj. He wants to hear about this, and he wants to hear about Vena and Anga. So Vidura inquired from the sage Maitreya, "My dear Brahmana, King Anga was very gentle. He had high character and was a saintly personality and a lover of Brahminical culture. How is it that such a great soul got a bad son like Vena, because of whom he became indifferent to his kingdom and left it?" Vidura also inquired, "How is it that the great sages who were completely conversant with religious principles, so they couldn't have done something wrong, but how they desired to curse King Vena, who himself carried the rod of punishment? He was the king. So what could this Vena have done? What kind of a person that he inspired the sages who are generally neutral, they take care of their own shastric business. What could he have done to inspire them, their anger, to curse and kill him? And thus awarded him the greatest punishment, because he was the king. The king is always respected, and in places when the rulers are not respected, it does something bad to the psychology of the citizens. And he continues asking this question: it is the duty of all citizens in a state never to insult the king, even though he sometimes appears to have done something very sinful. Because of his prowess, the king is always more influential than all other ruling chiefs. Vidura requested, "Maitreya, my dear Brahmana, you are well conversant with all subjects, both past and future. Therefore, I wish to hear from you all the activities of King Vena. I am your faithful devotee, so please explain this." Now Maitreya will begin his explanation that answers these questions about Vena and the sages and what he did that caused the sages to curse him. "My dear Vidura," Maitreya replied, "once the great king, Anga, arranged to perform the great sacrifice known as Ashvamedha. All the expert Brahmins present knew how to invite the demigods, but in spite of their effort, no demigods participated or appeared in that sacrifice." So Prabhupada takes the opportunity, after explaining Ashvamedha Yajna, in the last line, he says something that we will hear and we have heard so many times. "In this age, the only practical yajna is Sankirtan yajna, or chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, 24 hours a day. That is the way to not be touched by the material energy." I've heard Prabhupada say that so many times. "And if we can't, or be engaged in some direct devotional service, then for the other part of the time, we are prone to fall into ignorance." But in any case, this is the recommendation always. This is Mahaprabhu's gift. "Kalo nastiva 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 gatyanayata." The priests engaged in the sacrifice then informed King Anga, because he asked, how is it that the demigods aren't coming? Because that's supposed to happen if it's performed properly. So they said to him, "O king, we are properly offering the clarified butter in the sacrifice, but despite all our efforts, the demigods do not accept it. O king, we know that the paraphernalia to perform the sacrifice is well collected by you with great faith and care, and is not polluted, because it's very important where the sacrificial ingredients come from, because especially money, if money comes from a contaminated source, it can contaminate everything. So that, of course, we're not so discriminating about that, but we should be very careful that money that we get or collect is nothing sticks to our hands. We should give it to Krishna very carefully, especially money that's collected in the name of ISKCON. Because sometimes the money is very polluted, and it can really contaminate the consciousness of people who may think, one for Krishna, one for me, two for Krishna, one for me, two for me, one for Krishna. Anyway, so many people are giving to Krishna. No one's giving to me, so sometimes none for Krishna, three for me. Very, very dangerous, and really it tends to go in that direction. He's God, what does he need? I'm so tiny, I have so many needs. So the paraphernalia you're using is all pure, but still the demigods who are witnesses for the sacrifice do not accept their shares. We do not know why this is so. Oh, Prabhupada's purport is another heavy one, where he says that, well, we're doing deity worship, and he specially mentions worshipping Radha and Krishna, that we should be very careful of the seva aparats mentioned in nectar devotion, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And then he says, people who do not care about seva aparats, certainly the Radha Krishna deities will not accept the offerings from such non-devotees. A very heavy warning. So Maitreya explained that King Anga, after hearing the statements of the priests, was greatly aggrieved. Why? Because the sacrifice wasn't being successful. At that time, he took permission from the priests to break his silence and inquired from all the priests who were present in the sacrificial arena. Because there are certain times when a sacrifice you can speak and certain times you can't. So the right time he took permission, he asked the question, "My dear priests, kindly tell me what offense I have committed. Although invited, the demigods are neither taking part in the sacrifice nor accepting their shares." The head priest replied, he said, "O king, in this life we do not find any sinful activity." Just imagine, in his life he never performed a sinful activity, "even within your mind. So you are not in the least offensive. But we can see that in your previous life you performed sinful activities, due to which, in spite of your having all qualifications, you have no son. O king, we wish all good fortune for you. You have no son. But if you pray at once to the Supreme Lord and ask for a son, and if you execute the sacrifice for that purpose, the enjoyer of the sacrifice, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, will fulfill your desire. And when Hari, the supreme enjoyer of all sacrifices, is invited to fulfill your desire for a son, all the demigods will come with him and take their shares in the sacrifice." So the logic of the head priest is that the demigods won't come, but you satisfy Krishna for the purpose of having a son, you perform that type of a sacrifice, and then when Lord Vishnu comes, then the demigods will also come and you'll have a son too. "O king, we wish all good fortune for you. You have no son. But if you pray at once to the Supreme Lord and ask for a son, and if you execute the sacrifice for that purpose, the enjoyer of the sacrifice, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, will fulfill your desire. When Hari, the supreme enjoyer of all sacrifices, is invited to fulfill your desire for a son, all the demigods will come with him and take their shares in the sacrifice. The performer of the sacrifices under Karmakanda activities achieves the fulfillment of the desire for which he worships the Lord." So the devotee, Prabhupada explains in his purport, don't work to get something from Krishna, but don't be a karmi, a non-devotee. But he quotes Anya Abhilasita Sanyam, just desire Krishna's pleasure with no other desire. Anya Abhilas Sanya, other desires zero. That's the difference between a karmi and a devotee, Prabhupada says. So again, we should see, do I have other desires? Am I still a karmi? Let me become a devotee. "Thus, for the sake of a son for King Anga, they decided to offer oblations to Lord Vishnu, who is situated in the hearts of all living entities. And as soon as the oblation was offered to the fire, a person appeared from the fire wearing a golden garland and a white dress. He was carrying a golden pot filled with rice boiled with milk. The king was very liberal, udharadi, liberal. And that liberality caused him to give that sweet rice, that rice boiled in milk. That liberality, he gave that rice boiled in milk. He took the preparation in his joined palms, and after smelling it, he offered a portion to his wife. But his wife was not a proper recipient, because the son takes on the qualities of the mother. And this wife, Suniti, was the daughter of death personified. So that explains why Vena had the particular mentality that he had. So he was liberal, but his liberality, in this sense, became a fault. But because he was pure, his fault turned into a great blessing. Although the queen had no son, after eating that food which had the power to produce a male child, she became pregnant by her husband, and in due course of time she gave birth to a son. That boy was born partially in the dynasty of irreligion. His grandfather was death personified, and the boy grew up as his follower. He became a greatly irreligious person. After fixing his bow, now some descriptions of Vena, so we get an idea of his character. After fixing his bow and arrow, the cruel boy used to go to the forest and unnecessarily kill innocent deer. And as soon as he came, all the people would cry, "Here comes cruel Vena. Here comes cruel Vena." Prabhupada explains in his purport that the Kshatriyas who would have to kill, they were allowed to hunt in the forest and kill there. And sometimes he gives the example that because if you went to the forest, it would be very hard for you to shoot an animal and kill it, because we don't have that type of a mood. But a Kshatriya needs to develop that mood. So Prabhupada gave the example that a doctor who is going to perform operations, surgical operations, where he has to cut bodies, you can't do that. None of us could do something like that. Has anyone ever done something? Too difficult. But, so they practice on kadaivas, or dead bodies first, and therefore they build up their strength to be able to cut a body that survived. Yeah, too hard. So this was the practice. There was logic in it, but Vena was just unnecessarily killing. Cruel Vena. So from the very beginning of his life, he was terrifying to all the citizens. The boy was so cruel, and this is the extreme here, that while playing with young boys of his age, he would kill them very mercilessly, as if they were animals meant for slaughter. So what consciousness? Compare his consciousness to either Angas or Utkals. It was horrible. I mean, a devotee can't even consider doing these things. Can't even think about it. Even to think about killing someone is can't enter the consciousness. So after seeing the cruel and merciless behavior of his son, Vena, son Vena, King Anga punished him in different ways to reform him, but was unable to bring him to the path of gentleness. He thus became greatly aggrieved. The king thought to himself, "Persons who have no sons are certainly fortunate. They must have worshipped the Lord in their previous lives so that they would not have to suffer the unbearable happiness caused by a bad son." So much pain. He's saying the greatest fortune is not to have any son, because then you don't have to suffer a bad son. Just like if your arm is causing so much pain, you think the greatest fortune would be to get rid of the arm. A sinful son causes a person's reputation to vanish. His irreligious activities at home cause irreligion and quarrel amongst everyone. And this creates only endless anxiety. No benefit, only misery and anxiety. who, if he is considerate and intelligent, would desire such a worthless son? Such a son is nothing but a bond of illusion for the living entity, and he makes one's home miserable. But then he had a shift of consciousness. The king thought, a bad son is better than a good son, because a good son creates attachment for home, whereas a bad son does not. So misery has the benefit of causing detachment if one is wise. So we see this in Pingala, we see this in the Aila Gita. Because the attachment is the source of misery. Material attachment is the cause of misery. So he's thanking. My son is actually my greatest friend. He's my greatest friend because he's done the best thing for me. He's broken my attachment to home and family. Yes. So he thought his bad son as a good impetus for detachment for home life, and he considered his bad son his friend. This is from Prabhupada's purport, since he was helping him become detached from his home. Ultimately, one has to learn how to detach oneself from attachment to material life. Therefore, if a bad son by his bad behavior helps a householder to go away from home, it is a boon. Thinking like that, King Anga could not sleep at night. He became completely indifferent to household life. Once, therefore, in the dead of night, he got up from bed and left Vena's mother, his wife, who was sleeping deeply. He gave up all attraction for his greatly opulent kingdom, and unseen by anyone, he very silently gave up his home and opulence and proceeded towards the forest. When it was understood that the king had indifferently left home, all the citizens, priests, ministers, friends, and people in general were greatly aggrieved. They began to search for him all over the world, just as a less experienced mystic searches out the supersoul within himself. The less experienced mystic, he searches but finds nothing. At best, he finds impersonal Brahman to some degree. So similarly, the citizens, although searching for Anga, could not find him because he had already renounced everything and gone to the forest. When the citizens could not find any trace of the king, after searching from everywhere, they were very disappointed. And they returned to the city where all the great sages of the country assembled because of the king's absence. With tears in their eyes, the citizens offered respectful obeisances and informed the sages in full detail that they were unable to find the king anywhere. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the fourth canto, 13th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Description of the Descendants of Dhruva Maharaj. Thank you. Any questions or comments?
You mentioned that people will see the Lord everywhere. So, is this something that we are meant to emulate from our stage? And what is
you mean imitate or achieve?
Try to follow the example.
Of Utka? But not his external example. But he wasn't trying. One can't attain this by one's intellectual effort. That's why Prabhupada explained that one should practice bhakti yoga and chant Hare Krishna. And that will, and especially if we don't commit offenses, that will bring us to that ultimate platform.
Otherwise it will not be effective if I see
Well, that's better than nothing.
This is not the real substance.
That's more intellectual. This is springing from the depth of one's realization. And what you find that if it's just on the intellectual platform, Krishna will show you the limitation of that. And certainly at death, intellectual understanding will prove insufficient. One has to be deep. Bhagavad Vidhi and Pancharatriki Vidhi. That's what Prabhupada indicates here. Same thing, nothing new. There's some really nice verses that describe the Uttama Bhagavad in the 11th canto. And if there's a few moments at the end, I'll read those.
How we can understand that now that we spiritual arena of the Prachandas to praise the glories of Brahma. And whereas the Prachandas appeared in the Shakshu Shamani, and Brahma was in the Swayam Kami. So there's like 6 miles apart. And it seems that Ramani is just in no time entering that scene.
Yes, it seems that way.
So, is there any insight from that time?
Not that I'm aware of, but Narada Muni also takes part in Krishna Lila. He doesn't seem to be limited by either space or time because of his full taking shelter of Krishna and his ability to chant transcendental sound vibration. Swami Devi Mataji, did you have a question? Yeah. Yes.
Just to clarify, it means that we should endeavor to rather understand the true nature of the transcendent world. And then we'll naturally be able to see and not just to try to see him everywhere without...
You won't be able to.
You will not see him.
What Prabhupada explains, that this comes from advanced stages of love. So if one attains advanced love stages of love, then there won't be anywhere where one doesn't see him. And because it's not an intellectual adjustment, if one tries to do it without any love, as we tend to do, be somewhat imitative, we end up causing ourselves troubles. No imitation. So part of it is to understand him, to understand Krishna. Part of it is to understand oneself. Part of it is to understand the process, devotional service. Part of it is to chant the holy names properly. Part of it is to preach. It's so much a part of our process, because that makes one, it gives Krishna a little extra inclined to help. And we certainly need some extra help. So that's the whole process of Bhakti Yoga. That's Abhideya Tattva, which includes the Sambandhagyan. And also the depth of the Mahabhagavat's realization is only described externally here. And even when you hear Jadbharat, about Jadbharat, it's not fully clear. It is, but it doesn't describe the loving ecstasies in detail. An impersonalist, and it almost appears like that. But actually, he's not. So when you get the full-blown description of the Mahabhagavat's highest love for Krishna, you really get that in the 10th canto. Or Prahlad Maharaj, or Narada Muni. It describes also, doing a little research in the 11th canto, there's a comment by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, where he says that if you accept that a Mahabhagavat is one who sees the Lord everywhere, you could say that Narada Muni doesn't always see the Lord. So is he a Mahabhagavat? So he said, yes. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that even a continuous and full desire to see the Lord makes one an Uttama Bhagavat. So that's Tatra Loyam Apimulam Ekalam. That really deep, spiritually intense desire is really, or you could say sincerity even, is what it takes to see him. Specifically it mentions see him, but we would also say implicit in that is serve him, because a Mahabhagavat isn't a tourist, he's a servant. Not to go to the spiritual world to take photos and make a good slideshow so you can show everyone your attainments. No, it's service. If it's okay, I should finish it by just 5:30. Is it okay that I go till half? Is that the actual ending time? Okay, I'll just read these verses. This is the description of the three different types of devotees. There's 11 verses. The most advanced devotee, in this one description of the Bhagava Uttama. This is 11th canto, 2nd chapter, text 45 to 55. It's very similar to the verse we just read, this one. The most advanced devotee sees within everything the soul of all souls, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. Consequently, he sees everything in relationship to the Supreme Lord and understands that everything that exists is eternally situated within the Lord. An intermediate or second class devotee called a Madhyam Adhikari or Madhyam Bhagavat offers his love to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is a sincere friend to all the devotees of the Lord, shows mercy to ignorant people who are innocent, and disregards those who are envious of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A devotee who faithfully engages in the worship of the deity in the temple, but does not behave properly towards other devotees or people in general, is called Prakriti Bhakta, a materialistic devotee, and is considered to be in the lowest position. Even while engaging his senses in contact with their objects, one who sees this whole world as the energy of Lord Vishnu is neither repelled nor elated. He is indeed the greatest amongst devotees. Within the material world, one's material body is always subject to birth and decay. Similarly, the life air, prana, is harassed by hunger and thirst. The mind is always anxious. The intelligence hankers for that which cannot be obtained, and all of the senses are ultimately exhausted by constant struggle in the material nature. A person who is not bewildered by the inevitable miseries of material existence, who remains aloof from them simply by remembering the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is to be considered Bhagavat Pradhan, the foremost devotee of the Lord. One who has taken exclusive shelter of the Supreme Lord, Vasudeva, becomes free from fruitive activities which are based on material lust. In fact, one who has taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord is freed from even the desire to enjoy material sense gratification. Plans for enjoying sex life, social prestige, and money cannot develop within his mind. Thus he is considered Bhagavata Uttama, a pure devotee of the Lord on the highest platform. Birth in an aristocratic family and the extension of austere and pious activities certainly cause one to take pride in himself. Similarly, if one enjoys a prestigious position within society because his parents are highly respected members of the Vanashrama social system, one becomes even more infatuated with himself. But despite these excellent material qualifications, one does not feel even a tinge of pride within himself, he is to be considered the dearmost servitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When a devotee gives up the selfish conception by which one thinks, this is my property and this is his, and when he no longer is concerned with the pleasures of his own material body or indifferent to the discomforts of others, he becomes fully peaceful and satisfied. He considers himself simply one among all the living beings who are equally part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such a satisfied Vaishnava is considered to be at the highest standard of devotional service. The lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are sought even by the greatest of demigods, such as Brahma and Shiva, who have all accepted the Supreme Personality of Godhead as their life and soul. A pure devotee of the Lord can never forget those lotus feet in any circumstance. He will not give up his shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord for a single moment Indeed, not for half a moment, even in exchange for the benediction of ruling and enjoying the opulence of the entire universe, such a devotee of the Lord is to be considered the best of Vaishnavas. How can the fire of material suffering continue to burn the hearts of those who worship the Supreme Lord? The Lord's lotus feet have performed innumerable heroic deeds, and the beautiful nails on his toes resemble valuable jewels. The effulgence emanating from those nails resembles cooling moonshine, for it instantly relieves the suffering within the heart of the pure devotee, just as the appearance of the moon's cooling light relieves the burning heat of the sun. And the final verse. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is so kind to the conditioned souls that if they call upon Him by speaking His holy name, even unintentionally or unwillingly, the Lord is inclined to destroy innumerable sinful reactions in their hearts. Therefore, when a devotee who has taken shelter of the Lord's lotus feet chants the holy name of Krishna with genuine love, the Supreme Personality of Godhead can never give up the heart of such a devotee. One who has thus captured the Supreme Lord within his heart is to be known as Bhagavat Pradhan, the most exalted devotee of the Lord. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.